We should have our Bibles open to Job 38. And depending on what I can get through here, it does look like we may wind up holding off on this final issue. I don't know. We'll see how things go. Honestly, it's hard sometimes for me to talk about things without just wanting to shout about them. And what I want to bring to your attention in this last issue that we'll probably deal with on Tuesday, I'm to stand up and shout and sing and have a hallelujah chorus. It will be when you hear what you're about to hear. But for now, let's look at where we left off in Job chapter 38. We were looking there at verse 31, 32, and 33. We'll just cover that again. Canst thou bind the sweet influences of the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Canst thou bring forth Maseroth out of his season, or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons? Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven? Canst thou set the dominion thereof in the earth? That very phrase, set the dominion thereof in the earth, has to do with the fact that there is supposed to be this unified structure between the heavenly places and the earth. And you've got God talking to Job here about certain specific constellations. That's what those things are that are mentioned there. When he talks about the Pleiades, and I could show you charts of them, or you can, I was talking to Eric, that you can actually go to Google Earth, and you can, instead of looking at the earth, you can turn the thing around and look at the heavenly places and see some of these constellations. They're there today. But he talks about the Pleiades or Orion. I see Orion every night. If it's not cloudy, as I walk from my study to the house, why Orion's up there. I almost say hello to him every night. He's very easy to find. The belt of Orion. In fact, some people speculate that that's what the three major pyramids in Gaza in Egypt were about. That it was an attempt to try to chart out Orion, and the pharaohs believed that was the place of and again, it's interesting how other religions pick up on this. They pick up on the fact that, well, one of the Great Pyramid may have actually had this great big long hole built into it, so that the spirit of the pharaoh was supposed to, when the star aligned itself properly, shoot out his spirit up to Orion, which is where all the pharaohs live. And these concepts that you find, they're not really all that crazy, because God did, they're just counterfeits to what God has actually done and how he intends for the entirety of creation to function as a whole one day. And so you've got God talking to Job about certain specific constellations that are very significant. When he mentions these here, these are the ones that are so significant in connection with the physical structure of the realm of heaven. And these all, while some of them aren't the exact names maybe that we call them today, I don't know if Maseroth is really a name of a constellation today, but sometimes they get their names changed. But we certainly know about the Pleiades, we know about Orion, and those kinds of things. But what I'm after is that God mentions these constellations, sometimes, again, by not the same name we use, but he brings out these things because of how they specifically have a particular designed effect upon the physical structure of the heavenly places, and even how some of them have an impact upon the earth itself. And these things go beyond the ken of us understanding today, because we really won't understand anything or submit to understanding anything unless it's been written by a scientist in a science book. So when science looks at the constellations, they never look at the Pleiades, for instance, and think that they have a sweet influence. But there is an absolute truth that the Pleiades have a sweet influence on the earth. And my understanding is that when God comes along and starts, he's going to grab the earth, he's going to shake it terribly when the time of judgment comes on the earth and all these kinds of things, that influence is going to be taken down temporarily. That there's going to be something done to the Pleiades that no longer has its sweet influence. And you've got some other fascinating issues. In fact, hold your place here and come back to same book. Just come back a few chapters. Come back to the 26th chapter of Job. Job 38 isn't the only chapter that talks about these things. It's really kind of throughout the book you'll get segments that deal with it. Pick it up at verse 1, chapter 26, verse 1. Now, this is Job talking. He's answering one of his goofy friends, his religious friends. And it's the old, if ever that adage was true, it's true with Job. If these are your friends, who needs enemies? With friends like this, who needs an enemy? So he says, but Job answered. Now this is Bill after Bildad is, and all these friends are pretty much telling Job that everything that's going wrong with him is his fault. It's all because of him, some sin, some unrighteousness, some problem in his life. But Job answered and said, now he's going to knock Bildad down a few pegs here. How hast thou helped him that is without power? How savest the arm that has no strength? How hast thou counseled him that hath no wisdom? This, you got to laugh at this because that is such a slap in the face, but it's done so tactfully. You know, Job is almost admitting that the kind of counseling he has is what God is going to say, darken counsel with by words without knowledge. But I love that in verse 3. How is that? You think you've counseled me? How have you counseled someone when you have no wisdom? How hast thou counseled him that hath no wisdom? How hast thou plentifully declared the thing as it is? To whom hast thou uttered words, and whose spirit came from thee? Dead things are formed from under the waters. And what I want you to get here is Job's understanding of things. It wasn't just, look at the stars, isn't that great? Look at the earth, isn't that great? But he had real perception into these things. He said, dead things were formed from under the waters and the inhabitants thereof. Hell is naked before him, and destruction hath no covering. He stretched out the north over the empty place, and hangeth the earth upon nothing. Now, this is answer back to Bildad. And Job is now going to provoke Bildad's thinking by these statements of Job's understanding of how God structured the earth and the heavenly places together. He stretched out the north over the empty place. You know what I would ask there is, where's the empty place? Job knew where it was. He knew what it was. He hangeth the earth upon nothing. He bindeth up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. He holdeth back the face of his throne, and spreadeth his cloud upon it. Job understood the concept of God stretching the heavens as a curtain that hides God's throne. He hath compassed the waters with bounds until the day and night come to an end. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his reproof. These are real pillars in heaven. He divideth the sea with his power, and by his understanding he smiteth through the proud. By his spirit he hath garnished the heavens. And what I'm after in this passage is right here. With my understanding, and again, this is my understanding, is that when God created the heavens and the earth, the heaven and the earth on day one, day two, the six creation days, my understanding is that these constellations were not formed at that time. And it wasn't until God took the measures to separate the functionality and the responsiveness of the earth to the heaven, the heavenly places, because of the threat the Tower of Babel posed upon it, and he stretches everything out so that man can't get there, so he can't find those ways and paths until the intelligentsia gets up there to be able to do it. Otherwise, it would be like having an adversary in a business come in and start getting into the inner workings of the business and just muck the whole thing up, destroy it. And you've got the separation measures that God took in stretching the heavenly places out, and Job understood that very issue. And when he comes along here and he says that he hath by his spirit, by the way, that small case S, that's the Father And he's doing this according to his inner spirit. His spirit. That's not talking about the Holy Spirit. That's talking about he designed. In other words, when you look up at the stars, when somebody who's really, really skilled in astronomy, like Eric, when he looks up there and he sees all those things, the way they are now, after God has stretched everything out, and the way they sit up there, those things are up there by his hand. He put them there. And not only that, it's that he garnished them. They're not just up there as pretty things to look at. But God has specific structural, one of the things that many architects struggle with is the balance between functionality and beauty. Or aesthetically, something that's aesthetically pleasing. Because oftentimes something that's aesthetically pleasing has really no function to it at all. And oftentimes something that's structurally sound is not very good to look at. I mean, who wants to look at a bare girder, or something like that? What God did when he did this, he made it not only beautiful, but he made it functional. Those all have function. We like I said, you can see that structural part. But you can't see what's been hidden in vanity, what's been made subject to vanity. You can't see the sweet influences of the Pleiades. You can't see the bands of Orion, but they're there. That's not only something that is a beauty to behold, but it has absolute intricate structural functionality for the entire universe, the whole creation of the heavenly places to stay where they are, to hold everything they're to hold, and to have the ability to function as God wanted them to function. And it's a beautiful verse that describes, by his Spirit he hath garnished the heavens. His hand hath formed the crooked serpent. That crooked serpent there is one of the constellations. And his hand formed that. And my understanding is that has something to do with the adversary. That's why that's called a crooked serpent. And I'm not going to get into this, but I really do believe that has a very vital aspect for some things the adversary has done in the heavenly places to have a specific way of dealing with those things. And God put that up there, and he formed that. And that was not during the creation week. When God, on day four, had created the sun, the moon, and the stars, Satan hadn't become the serpent yet. So this was after that. In fact, my understanding is this actually happened after the flood of Noah. That's one of the reasons why when you go and we won't go over there and look at it, but when you have Peter talking about Noah's day and the judgment of the flood of Noah, he talks about that period of time of Noah's flood and before as the world that then was. And almost as if you have to have an entirely, totally different frame of reference to conceive of how the heavens and the earth existed at that time, different than how they exist today. And you see, science never recognizes this. They won't. They recognize a constant. They recognize a big bang, and that an explosion produced incredible. Order. Explosions don't produce order. I'm sorry to tell you that, but logic would tell you that, but when was a scientist logical? So you have these constellations being given. You have this one here called the crooked serpent. And honestly, I'm not sure which one that is. There's a couple of them right now. I think that might be Hydra, but I'm not real sure. But the crooked serpent that's mentioned there is a constellation. God formed that. And when God talks about these structures of heaven, the constellations and everything, and he talks about them, they're not just being discussed as some kind of astronomical phenomenon type thing, or even as a sign for the seasons. You have the 12 zodiac or something, and you have the way that you can chart the stars and chart their movement and chart the constellations as being set up there for seasons. But that's a legitimate purpose that they have. God tells you that the stars, the sun, the moon, they're all set there for signs and for seasons. But this when God talks about them this way, he's not talking about them as just being up there as signs of the season, but they're also talked about in connection when he talks about in this section things about the garnishing of the heavens. And over there, you can come back now to Job 38. In Job 38, when he talks about the verses we read about the pillars and about the foundation and about the cornerstone and about the fastenings of the foundation, there, all of these stars and all of these structures of the heavenly places, the constellations and things that he mentioned, my understanding is those things are not just talked about as being signs of seasons, but they're also talked about in connection with the very fabric of that realm. They have something to do with the very fabric of the realm of the heavenly places. They're also talked about as being part of... Here's something else I wanted you to see. Come back to Job 38:33. Verse 33 says, "Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven?" Now, that's not talking about munitions. The ordinances, what is an ordinance? You know, you have to ask yourself, what is he talking about here? "Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven?" We talk about the communion service sometimes as an ordinance. You know, that may not be the best way to talk, but we when we think of an ordinance, we either think of it as some kind of a ritual, or in the military, you're talking about ammunition, munitions, you know, ordnance. Usually is cannonballs or, you know, artillery rounds or something like that. You're going to put some ordnance on the spot. But when you think about ordinances of heaven in Job 38:33, an ordinance is something that has been... What's the basic concept of ordinance? Well, ordained. What's the basic concept of ordained? Shorter word. No, same. The same O-R-D... Order. Yeah. When you're talking about an ordinance, it's something that has been ordered and something that has been arranged. An ordinance is an arrangement of parts. And it's interesting that you can find that the word ordinance is a very, very good term to describe an architectural structure. We only think of it in terms of an ordered ritual or an order the order of ammunition. But in many contexts, it can be used as a very powerful term in association with various arrangement of parts as in architecture, to create a structure, to create a building. And when the context demands that that's the context it needs to be in, it's the most excellent term to describe. "Knowest thou the ordinances of heaven?" All of its structure. It's got all of this architectural, structural aspect to it. That God has put in place there, and it's something that has various parts, and it's arranged as architecture in accordance with a plan or a purpose. In other words, when he formed that, he formed it just as the blueprint called for, and he created it like the blueprint. He designed it like the blueprint, and therefore the ordinances are of heaven are the material fabric of it. They're the material apparatus that are appropriately set in order for a particular plan of action to be carried out. God set all this stuff up, not just to make it pleasing in his sight, but it's got functionality to it. It's got a plan and a purpose that an action that is supposed to be carried out. And those are going to have the ordinances of heaven provide for the orderliness of the heavenly places, and they also provide for the maintenance of its structure, to maintain its structure. God put Orion up there that has bands. He put Pleiades up there that has ordinances connected with it to have sweet influences. He put Arcturus up there. He put Maseroth up there. He put the crooked serpent up there. He put all of these things there that, again, this you may just think, Mark's really been taking a lot of Valium or something, but my understanding is that those are all aspects that one day when that creature gets delivered from its bondage of corruption, there's going to be levers and there's going to be machinations up there and things that are in connection with all of these that we'll be able to know what button to push, what lever to pull, what exactly how all of these mechanically function to bring finally start generating life in that thing. And it's an amazing departure from the way most people ever approach this kind of terminology. But that terminology is real. And those ordinances provide for its the orderliness of the heavens and the maintenance of its structure. Now, remember that I told you that this issue of a son being called simple in phase one of level two has two sides to it. And really all we've been talking about this morning is the side that has to do with the father's business. What's the other side? The side that has to do with the policy of evil. Well, as the issue of the kind of subtlety that the son gets in order to cure him being the simple son, along with understanding and appreciating some things about our father's business in the heavenly places, that subtlety is also being given in regard to Satan's plan of evil. And I say plan of evil as opposed to his policy of evil. And even here in Job, we can say something about that other side of the coin, so to speak, something about the physical structure of the heavenly places that has a connection with the adversary and his plan of evil. And when God wants to both judge the heavenly places, kind of getting out there in our timeline chart once again, when that is all taking place, we got a lot of fuzz on here right now this morning, but when God goes to judge the heavenly places, both there and deal with certain areas within that, the adversary has come along, where the adversary has come along, and my understanding is, oops, I meant to do 39. My understanding is that in the creature, where's my creature? All right. In the creature, not only are these wonderful things that God put up there, but there's also, in association with the adversary and his plan of evil, God is going to have to judge in the heavenly places and deal with certain areas within the heavenly places that the adversary has come along and, in a very real way, he's smart. The adversary is very, very brilliant in what he did. Remember, the creature is the area that he first took control of before the earth. And when he did that, he was very smart in the way he did it. He structured this with a lot more depth than most people ever understand. Every time you hear some idiot go running around and say, "The devil's after me and he's going to be after you and blah, 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 and we're going to, you know, put the devil down and rebuke him and all of this," it's just ridiculous. But my understanding is that along with God judging the heavenly places, he's going to have to do that because of areas within that heavenly place where the adversary has come along and made these little areas. I think the best way to describe them are fortresses for himself and for his cohorts. In other words, what I've been trying to generate in your thinking is that without any real detail, this whole apparatus of the universe has a real structure to it. It has real places to it. Therefore, like a house, like a building, there are certain key places on a house that if they get destroyed, the whole house comes down. You can a house in a hurricane. We had some back when Fran hit tornado. One of the things that an insurance agent will do when he gets onto a site, and I've been in probably more tornadoes than you really know about, and I never want to be in one. I don't want to see one. I don't want to chase one. I don't care if I never see nor hear of a tornado again in the rest of my life. I hate them. I don't want to be around them. I know what they can do. I've seen people die in them. I've been picked up in them. And they're not fun things to be around. And the adjusters will come around, the insurance adjusters will come around, and when they evaluate the damage of a house, oftentimes there'll be a lot of damage to it, but they'll come along and they'll say, but it's still structurally sound. And so you get your money and you rebuild. And you can, it's interesting because sometimes you can see a house that really doesn't look all that badly damaged. But something happened to its foundation. Something happened to it structurally that compromises the entire building. When you talk about the heavenly places having a cornerstone, and you talk about the earth having a cornerstone, you talk about the heavenly places having pillars to them, there are some, one of the things you always have to be careful of when you knock a wall down is whether or not it's a load-bearing wall. If it's a load-bearing wall, you could compromise the structure of your roof. And if you compromise that, compromise the structure of an outer wall, and you've really got a serious problem. The heavenly places are designed that way. And the adversary knows it. Remember what we read when it said when God did all these things, the sons of God sang with joy? One of those was an angel by the name of Lucifer. And he saw how this thing was erected. And he knows where to fortify that. He just like in a war, nobody, no infantry officer of any kind engages an enemy without an exit strategy, without several different strategies of if we get breached here, we fall back to this area. And if we get breached here, and usually if the enemy keeps coming and they finally get to their last stand, usually they would, I don't know if they do it anymore, but they'll designate a place and they'll say, that's the Alamo. That's where we're going to make our final stand. But that's like the last resort. There's a whole bunch of other plans to deal with defensive maneuvers and things like that before you ever get to that. Well, in that very crude way of illustrating that, the adversary has done that with the heavenly places. He's thought out what would happen if God started to repossess them. And he's actually taken measures to fall back to certain fortifications, and he has, just like he did on this earth when he fortified Canaan, and he brought the Canaanites to fortify and just destroy produce the kind of uncleanness that could be produced in the land of Israel. He's done the very same thing in the heavenly places. By the way, we're supposed to know where those things are, because God's going to judge those, and we're going to have to go in there and do. But what I'm after is that you realize that when he did that, he's come along, and as it were, he's fortified certain areas whereby he's going to have fortifications for himself and for his cohorts. One of the things you ought to realize is he's been really busy up there. He's done a lot of stuff. Because when he did what Ezekiel 28 says in connection with implementing his plan of evil in the heavenly places, he not only, remember there it talks about his merchandise he is trafficked in? That's, you need to understand what that's about. He not only went and sold his wares, sold his bill of goods, his merchandise in the sanctuaries of the principalities, but he went and he established fortresses in various places, and God deals with those areas exactly like that, as fortresses of the adversary. These are places of darkness, spiritual darkness in those heavenly places. And the adversary knew very well what he was doing, because my understanding is when he goes out there and determines where he's going to establish a fortress, he does it at the integral place, or what we might call a linchpin, or probably the better term to use is a keystone. If you understand what a keystone is for in a bridge, where you have all the bridge coming out, and you have a keystone in there that actually bears the weight, so that if you were to pull the keystone out, the whole thing would just fall down. Well, my understanding is that Satan did that. He knew where these keystones and linchpins that were integral to the very structure of the framework of the heavenly places, where those resided, and he went there, and he actually put fortresses there. He set up strongholds in the very places in the heavens that really hold it all together. That's why when you've got God talking to Job and saying, as for darkness, this is Job 38, 20, 19 and 20, what we read last time. When he says, and as for darkness, where is the place thereof? You see that? He says, where is the way where light dwell? As for darkness, where is the place thereof? There's a place that up there in the heavenly places where that is, that thou shouldest take it to the bound thereof, and thou shouldest know the paths to the house thereof. There is a particular path that leads to that fortification of darkness. That is, Job, do you know the road that's going to take you up there to that realm of darkness where that guy's set up his fortress? And he's set up his place to reside? Because if you're going to deal with him, if you're going to deal with that adversary, you're going to have to start to deal with the implementation of his plan of evil. You've got to be able to get up there. And there's a path to that house, that fort. You got to be able to go where his fortresses are. You got to be able to know where they are. That's why God asked Job those questions. That's not God just coming along and wanting to get Job to look up to the heavens and say, "Wow, what a great thing you did. This is really big. It's really vast. It's really pretty." And all that stuff. That's sitting back in Psalm 19. You know, when you consider the heavens, the handiwork, and all this kind of thing. And that's for dumb Gentiles. I'm not trying to disparage that or minimize that. That's a big deal. But that's for ignorant Gentiles to just look up to the heavens and say, "Wow, look at that." That's not what God's doing with Job here. And he's not just trying to get Job to look up to the heavens and say to himself, "Well, this thing is so vast and big and so wonderful. I don't understand a thing about it." That's not what he's doing. Job's having to take on the adversary here. The adversary's attacked him. That is fundamental to understand that about the heavens. Job was smart enough. Job was intelligent enough. And he was godly enough for God to pit the adversary against him. And Job would stand through it all. And he did. The biggest enemy Job had wasn't the adversary. It was his three religiously stupid friends and his wife. Curse God and die. I think I performed that wedding. As weddings go for me. Yeah, I think they both came to my study and had some real deep counseling and told me how much they loved each other, and so I married them, and now it's curse God and die. She was a peach. I wouldn't be surprised if that wasn't her name. Peach. Mrs. Peach Job. She's a peach. Yeah. But one of the reasons Job's three friends were so evil and such a problem was because they were so religious. It was because they were so close to being right. And they were so, they were full of the exact terminology of godliness. But they were using it in an ungodly way. Well, Job understood all those things. And he knew what the adversary had done out there. He knew he had fortified those heavenly places. And Job had the intelligence when it came to these, to how those ordinances of heaven were set up and the importance of them and the way in which they provided for the architectural structure of the heavenly places. And by that I mean how the whole thing was put together and the whole thing was held together. My understanding is, and again it's just my understanding, but if I'm right, that's why God asked Job in Job 38:31, he says, "Canst thou loose the bands of Orion?" That's a strategic place. And my understanding is that if you can loose the bands of Orion, the whole structure of the heavenly places all fall down. That is one of the most integral linchpins or keystones in the entire heavenly places. And if you can loose those bands, the whole structure falls apart. The heavenly places start to come apart at the seams. Now, you're going to have to spend time on that yourself. And if you're not convinced of that, I'm not really all that. I mean, it's not that big a deal. But I'm just giving you my quick understanding of it. But these are some of the things. These things we've been talking about, the constellations, the way the heavenly places are structured, both as a creature, as an architectural structure, especially the constellations that we've been talking about here, all those things God did after the flood. Like I said, He put the measures into place to keep and to separate the creature from the earth so that that man could not get up there and screw the whole thing up, especially after the Tower of Babel incident took place. So when it comes to the issue of getting back to gaining the subtlety, the cure for this is going to be when we recognize by the information our Father is going to give us, and if your mind is going to be greatly occupied with these kinds of things when you get to Ephesians, and he starts. That's why you've got. I mean, think about this sometime. Think about those, especially. I know you've got Philippians sandwiched in between Ephesians and Colossians, and that's for a reason, because of what Philippians especially deals with at a particular level of stage of level 2. But when you think about Ephesians and Colossians being the bookends to that information, you start realizing why Paul exhorts you to set your affections upon the things that are above, not on the things that are on this earth. That's not just a dispensational issue. It's far more than that. That's an issue of, that's where your Father's business is. That's where you have some intelligent understanding of what's going on, how that structure's put together, what your role is going to be in connection with it. And some of that gets spelled out to you in the very first couple chapters of the book of Ephesians. That's why Paul spends time in Ephesians talking, setting the framework of how you're going to be thinking now upon being seated with Christ in the heavenly places. And why he has to bring in the dispensational aspect of it to begin saying, now that you know the fact of it, now you need to begin to perceive the genius that's behind it. When you perceive genius behind something, you're getting subtlety. That's curing that flat, one-dimensional concept that you've been in. You see that? Just spend a little time in just those two books, and just give Ephesians a read through. It won't take you long. Colossians even shorter. And look at the kind of terminology that starts getting you to start thinking about the heavenly places with some real acute perception and a finer way of seeing things than you ever were told about in the book of Romans. And it's really fascinating just to kind of draw that to a close of the kind of subtlety we get and the power that's contained in all of that. All I've done here is not even scratch the surface. I've just kind of run around on top of the surface, pointing a couple things out. But we're out of time, and it's a good time to stop, because I'm at my note in my class notes that says, do not go on and teach the following unless you have time to do it. So I don't have time to do it. It's almost like a message from on high. But it's probably good that we don't think about what I'm about to say with all this fresh on our minds. We'll give it a day or two and come back on Thursday or Tuesday, not Thursday, Tuesday. But what I want to do, and what you might want to do, is spend a little time in the first couple chapters of Ephesians just giving it a read over before you get to Bible class on Tuesday night. Because what I want to do is, I want to tell you something that up to this point is probably one of the most profoundly personal impact-making issues that we've ever been confronted with. I mean, it goes beyond just being adopted as a son. But it has to do with some perception into... That is horrible. Deal with that. I'm going to turn it off. That doesn't deserve to be on. But it deals with the issues that we're going to look at to get some statement about what the next dispensation is going to be like. The dispensation of the fullness of times. When God, through the church, the body of Christ, and the new creature, being the new creature, takes that creature, takes the new heavens and the new earth, joins them together, and begins to function with them, there is something that happens to a son there that is absolutely beyond almost all words to describe it. And I want to tell you what it is. Because actually, you're told about it in those first two chapters of Ephesians. It's just that most people completely overlook what it is. And we'll talk about that and explain that as the final issue before we get back and start carrying on with the table of contents in level 2. All right, so with